Bakasha.
Okay, I feel it's appropriate to mention we lost another giant this week. That's you see his picture there of Gedalia Dov Schwartz. I mentioned also because, as I said, one of his grandsons has been a long-time listener. Just a couple of things I'll say about him. Well, first of all, hold on, let me stop sharing. You can read about him on a very good article of Rabbi Matanz. I think his name Matanz, whatever. I don't know, from Chicago, on the Lair House. Although I do have to point out that he says, hold on a second, I'll get it. He says in the article, I'll read you the exact words here, that Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz is the first second generation American Talmud Chacham to publish Chiddushei Torah. That's clearly not correct. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz did publish a sefer in 1959, but we had plenty of American Talmidei Chachamim publishing Chiddushei Torah before him. Rabbi Gifter, for instance, in I think it's 1944 in the Talpiot, he's publishing, and we have many others if you look in Hapardes. So then you might want to say, well, maybe he's the first to publish a sefer. First, that is American born. I don't know why this language that he used, second generation American. No, he means American born. That's not true at all either. I'm going to show you now what I believe is the first sefer ever published by a an American born Torah scholar. And I know we have many scholars of all sorts of areas listen to us. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is it. It's called Otsara Sota. It's a commentary on the laws of Hilchos Sota and the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, written by none other than Eliezer Tzvi Revel. That's Bernhard Revel's son. And this was published in 1941. I believe this is the first sefer ever published. He published other sefarim as well, but this was his first. This is after his father passed away. His father died young. Eliezer Tzvi Revel also. He died, I think, in his 50s, also never married. Bernhard Revel has no descendants. And I believe, so the bibliographer is with us, can correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first sefer ever published by an American born Talmud Chacham. In terms of Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz's work, you can see, actually, we have so many things I want to show you. I'm going to delete this for now. You can see this work. It's called the Sha'arei Gedula. It's a collection, first of all, of halachic things, the answers he gave. But even more than that, and which is most interesting, is the first half of it. It's a historical overview of American Orthodoxy. Anyone who wants, look, we have histories of American Orthodoxy. We have one in particular, this one of Jeffrey Gurach, but this is more of a social history. If you want to know the halachic literature, there's all halachic literature from the 19th century. Before, let's say, 19, World War II, great rabbis were here in far-flung places, from Bangor, Maine, to Montpelier, Vermont, to Omaha, Nebraska. You had real first-class Talmidei Chachamim who, for financial reasons, were forced to come to America, and they were all over the United States, and they published Sfarim. And if you want to do a history of the way I would do it, of halacha, the history of Orthodoxy, looking at through rabbinic literature, halacha, Rabbi Schwartz's first hundred, well, actually, it goes up to 200 pages, 231. Well, the first part is dealing a biographical sketch. So about 180 pages dealing with kashrus and mikvos and conversion. Very, very nice. His grandson. Well, first, let me show you a picture that they have in this book, because we've mentioned this idea a lot already. Here it is. So when he received an honorary degree from YU, there he is. He's in his gown, cap and gown. I showed you last week from the MTJ boys, a few of them. I didn't mention, incidentally, last week that MTJ, that big book I have, gives a list of all the rabbis serving at the Well, this was when it came out about 10 years ago, as rabbis in American communities in Israel and yeshivas, etc. Very impressive. I had no idea that there were so many musmachim of distinguished musmachim from MTJ. One more thing I just want to show you. So I thank Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz's grandson, who gave this to me, and I wrote about this last year. The Rav wrote a letter, which about the, it appeared in the book about, in Natty Helfgott's book, Community Covenant and Commitment. And before that, it appeared in, let me show you that, I don't have the title page here, The Sanctity of the Synagogue. However, the original letter of the Rav was found in the archives of Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, as in his house. You can see in the top here, confidential, members of rabbinical council only. And it actually, and this might be the only copy that survives from the 50s. And Rabbi Schwartz's grandson sent it to me. It has a very interesting point in it, which anyone who wants to write about the Rav needs to know about, because he has a couple paragraphs here. You can go to the Sfarim blog in November of 2018, and you can, I included those paragraphs, which he speaks about how sometimes you can't just, you can't give an answer that people want. He says, Teku is a very prominent and characteristic feature of Parashat Baal Peh. We members of the Halachah Commission are not partners in a contracting firm whose task it is to provide every member of the Rabbinical Council of America with a clear-cut answer to his problems. Quite often, the solution eludes us. We are beset by grave doubts. We face many alternatives, not knowing which to choose, since each is supported by sound logical reasoning. We cannot be guided in our decisions by emotional factors or pragmatic arbitrariness, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says that the decisions sometimes seem to inconvenience some of our members. And so this is a very important passage. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, by the way, served as rabbi of the, as the Abbestin of the RCA. Okay, let us move on. A couple more things. We're going to get to next week. We'll get to the issue I want to deal with. What is it? Oh, you're saying God's name that Moshe asked at the end of last class. Can you say God's name? We'll get to that. Just too much to do today. Oh, okay. Two more things. Three more things, actually. This will take us probably till 10 off. Do you know this book? I just want to clarify last week. This is Daniel Sperber's great, the volume 5 of his study of Minhagim. I know a lot of people were surprised about last class, what I said about the menorah. And then I said it's in the implication of the Shulchan Aruch also. So let me show you what I'm talking about. And it's in Yonah D'Yoma. If you look in the Torah, Simon 673, what the Torah says is that when you write the Neres Hanukkah, you don't make a hefsek that is with other lights. Therefore, he says, the last one, the Acheron, is not for Hanukkah. So there, what is it for? The Torah says it is for the light. So if you use it, you're using a light. You're not using a menorah. And then the Torah says, Ve'ein shem shamash alav. We do not call this candle the shamash. Why? Because ki ha-shamash hu ha-madlik bo ha-nero. Because we already use the shamash to light the menorah. So we see from the Torah they had two lights. Now, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, what does he say here? He says as follows. He's not so clear. His language, he's quoting the Torah, but he's not 100% clear. He says, V'noagim hadlik ner nosaf. He says, we're accustomed to light an additional ner, additional candle. K'dei she'im yishtamesh l'ora yelor ha-nosaf. He says that so that if you use it, you're not using the menorah. Now, what's not clear about the Shulchan Aruch here is because he's actually referring here to the second light, not the shamash. He's referring to the one you light afterwards. You see that if you read the Torah. And the Ramah says, Uv Medino Selu, that is in Poland, Einu Oglim Hosef, Rak Maneach Etzana Shamash. So the Ramah says, in our lands, we don't have this separate light candle. We just have the shamash. So we see that the Shulchan Aruch, and what's the reason? Well, the reason is there's two. There's the one you light it with, and then there's the one that you use so that you don't get benefit from the light of the menorah. And we use the Shamash for that. But you see, that's what I meant when I said the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, he sort of abridges it, so it's not really clear, but he's quoting the Torah, that's the Rama understands them. And when he says the Nogi Muhadik Ner Nosaf, that's after lighting the candles, that's referring to the second one you light. Okay. Two things before I get to big question last week, which I think you will find of interest. Is Susanna with us? If not, I'm going to hold off till she's with us, because she'll like this. If she doesn't write in, I'm going to hold off till next week for Susanna, and that way we won't.
I'm here.
Oh, Susanna's here. Okay. So Susanna made a very good point last week about how sometimes even in Tanakh, you have things that don't go in accordance with the rules. So I want to show you a couple of things here. Delete this. Here's Tehillim. Some of these Tehillim we know very well. Lamed Vav Yud Beis. What does it say here? Hold on, I want to move my screen up here. Al Tavo'eni Regel Gava, let not the foot of pride overtake me. V'yad Rasha'im Al Tenideni, and let not the hand of the wicked drive me away. What is this word, Al Tavo'eni? It's a very strange word. You would expect to say Tavo'eli. We don't have the Nun Yud ending in a case like that, but this, it rhymes. You see the Nun Yud ending, Tenideni, so you have Tavo'eni. Another example. Look over here. This is number Mem. Look at Zion. It's talking about the different sacrifices, and it says Ola v'chata lo sha'alta. Burnt offering and sin offering hast thou not required. What do you mean chata? It should be chatat. But again, the rhyming Ola v'chata. Here we go. Another example in Tehillim. Look in Gimel. Imru Elohim, saying to God, Manu Rama Secha. That's Manu Rama Secha. That's a little unusual. You would assume it would be Man Poral, Nora, Noraim, perhaps. Is there another one I want to show you? Ah, so look at here. Five. Verse five. Looking at verse five. No, verse eight. The ani barov chazdecha avove techa. Eshtacha ve el hecha kachacha biyira techa. What do you mean biyira techa? It's strange. You'd expect maybe biyira. I guess that maybe that's not grammatical per se, but it's just unusual. Okay, so now where do I get all these examples from? And there's many, many more examples I can give you. I get it from this book, actually. This book. I found a very interesting book years ago called Darchei HaMalitza B'Sefer Tehillim by a Lithuanian who went to Eretz Yisrael, wrote Sfarim, and then he came to America. William Grossman's in English, in Hebrew, Zev Grossman. Look, the book has an approbation by William Chomsky. William Chomsky, who's a great grammarian, is the father of none other than Noam Chomsky. I don't think William Chomsky, who was one of the leading scholars of Hebrew, as far as I know, he was an anti-Zionist. So Grossman wrote this book, and he points out something which I find really interesting. He says as follows. You don't just speak about Tehillim. He gives an example here. Look in, this is Perichof Tes 35. What does it say here? V'asisa l'Aaron ovanav. And thus shall you do to Aaron and his sons. Sorry, v'asisa l'Aaron ovanav kacha. Kachol asher tzivisi, all that I have commanded, osacha. What is this osacha about? Where do you ever see this word osacha? Mm-hmm. You never say it, see that. But notice, it's for the rhyme. The asiso aronovanav kacha, kachol asher tzivisi, osacha. That there's an example where even in Torah itself, we see variations from what we'd expect normal grammar, what it, quote, should be, in order for the rhyme. I was looking in this book. It's so interesting, because at the end, it gives his books, and lo and behold, he published this book. Let me show you where he published it. And in the 40s. Hold on a second. Exactly. I don't, the title page doesn't have it here, but I will. Yeah, it's the 40s or 50s here. No, 54. Yeah, 54. So he has the last pages. Look at this. Tmunus Migdol Yisrael. He sold pictures of the great rabbis, Rashi, Rambam, Yosef Karo, the Ramah, the Grav, Shneur Zalman, of Liadi, Sfir Kalasher, the Chafetz Chaim, on a card. And that you could put them on the, this is the, put them on the, near the wall of the school or the Beis Medrash. So this is the rabbi cards. We all know about rabbi cards, right? I used to collect them. Zev Elif, the indefatigable Zev Elif. He has an article, right? I'm not, came out a few years ago, Gedolim cards and the commodification of rabbis' things. I used to collect these cards at my brother also did that. My brother's bar mitzvah for the tables of the seating, instead of like one, two, three, it was different Gedolim. So we had the Ben Ishchai and this and that. And then we had some giant ones hanging on the ceiling. One of them looked like this. This is, of course, the famous of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. I took this. It's a huge. It was like 3 feet, and I brought it to the JC where I was a student, and I hung it on the wall of our classroom. And I come back a day or two later, and it's not there. And people told me that Rabbi Teitz took it off. So I didn't understand why would Rabbi Teitz take off the poster of Rabbi Chanan. I know that I didn't know then that Rabbi Chanan was controversial in some of his views, but it's still not a reason to take him off. I went to Rabbi Teitz, and he said that the room that was my classroom, they use it since we use it for davening mincha. You can't have a picture, even of a gadol, on it because it's used. You could, let's say, someone could like bow in that direction, whatever. He says in a shul, you don't have pictures of gadolim. I guess not. Although if you go into that room I showed you 2 weeks ago, the small, not the big shul, but like the Beis Medrash in Tunis, they have pictures of the great Tunisian rabbis in the actual shul itself. And don't get me started about Chabad. Obviously, they have a picture of the Rebbe. Okay, the last thing I want to do now is I want to give an introduction for a minute, and then we'll get to the question, and this will take us like 5 more minutes or so. We spoke about poetry a bit. We spoke about how it doesn't have to always be in accordance with grammatical rules. Ashkenazim, for instance, if you read Bialik's poetry, it's in accordance with, and Chernyakhovsky, it rhymes Ashkenazim. So it's not that Bialik is wrong. That's how the Ashkenazim pronounce it. Not in Torah reading. I'm talking about poems. The best example of this, which you all know, even if you don't realize you know it, is Hatikvah. Hatikvah, which we all know it how it's sung, but also they say the meter, I'm not so good at meter, is the same thing. But it's Ashkenazic. The whole thing is Ashkenazic. And it's strange because Israelis today all recite it, but it's not done. For example, we don't say "Od lo avda tikvatenu." It's "Od lo avda ha-tikva," not "ha-tikva." It's "Liot am chafshi," not "Liot am chafshi." "Tzion," not "Tzion," and that's okay because, again, that's it's written and it's sung by Ashkenazi. Now, why do I give this as an introduction? I give this as an introduction for the following reason. Last class, I read as follows, and I'll show you what I read. I was reading Adonolam, we are pronouncing it, and I said the second to bottom line there, out of Kidruchei, I said Beis Sham Ha'ira, and Mel pointed out to me, and then we had a correspondence, and he gave me permission to cite him, that when I said Va'ira, it actually is incorrect. It should be Va'ira. Because look, you see the line right there, just like over here, Lach Bira. And then he said that And so the only reason we say Beis Hisham V'Ayira is because of the tune, the song. And he said, points out, look above here, we say the second line. What do we say? As I melech. We don't say melech, we say as I melech with the accent on the end. And his point is, and I said to him, I'll speak about this next week. And Mel says he doesn't know what's there to discuss. The correct stress is clearly marked in the sitter. And you do see the line there in the Arch scroll under Melech, under Aira. By the way, someone is, I hear someone, so someone has to be muted. This line, we know it's the Meteg. In Torah, we call it, in the Chumash, we call it a Gaia. Here it's a Meteg. By the way, don't always rely necessarily that the Meteg's correct. For instance, I found that Art Scroll gets, in the Birkos HaShachar, Art Scroll gets it right in the morning. It's we have a bracha sha'asali called Sarki. He has, hold on, let me get it, make sure I don't confuse the two. The dispute actually, that word, the last word, it's Sarki or Tsarki, but sha'asali, Art Scroll gets it right. Koren gets it wrong. Koren has sha'asali. It's definitely, it's Mila'el for the reasons we spoke about. But Koren gets the first bracha right. Asher nasan lasechvi vina. Art Scroll gets it wrong. We know that. It's a pasuk in Art Scroll even tells you it's an eel. So it's not sechvi, it's sechvi. But this is Mel's point. Every siddur I checked all the siddurim. They all put the dash there, Melech, Achbira, Ira. So they all agree. And yet I'm going to tell you now that in my opinion, they're all wrong. And therefore, although Mel says that he wonders what they're discussed, the correct stress is clearly marked on the sitter, I tell you right now, the correct stress is not marked on the sitter. And all these Sidurim are wrong for the reason I'm going to explain now. Yes, the word Melech is to be written. If you just have the word melech, we know that whenever there's a three, two segels, it's the first syllable. So, for example, the word lechem, you don't say lechem, you say lechem, which incidentally in benching is an example of where the song does mess it up. Who knows saying lechem achobasar? We pronounce it lechem when it should be lechem. But okay, so that's with a song you can. I guess be incorrect. But my point is that this is not even incorrect. And let me explain to you, and I'm going to prove this to you in two ways, and then Mel and the rest, you either accept it or you won't accept it. But let me explain to you why. Because if a poem is written from the beginning to be pronounced a certain way, even if it doesn't fit in with what we call grammar, then it is, that's the way to do it. So when Mel says that there are people in his shul who go against the tune and put the stresses on the correct syllables, I say, no, they're putting the stresses on the wrong syllable because you can't argue with the author. And let me explain to you what I mean now. The author intended it to be written in a certain way. And in poetry, it doesn't need to be guided. So for example, here you can see Adon Olam. Let me just read you the first two lines, how this works. It goes as follows. You have eight syllables, and it goes no stress, stress, no stress, stress, no stress. So it goes Adon Olam Asher Malach B'Terem Kol Yetzir Nivra Le'et Nasa V'Chef Tzokol Zay Melech Shemo Nikra. So you see very clearly that the way the poem is set up, and we don't know who wrote this poem. It's a medieval, apparently in Spain, but we don't know who wrote it. You see very clearly that the way it's designed to be read, it's not melech. And if someone recites the song and tries to make it azai melech instead of melech, he's going against the intent of the author, and the author is entitled to create a poem the way he wants. Now, as for how I recited the end of the line, va'ira, not va'ira, just look at how they are. Veloha oz v'hamisra, v'tzorach levli be'esara, menaskosi b'yomekra, v'esi shan v'aira, Hashem li v'lo ira. It is obviously designed to be read that way, despite the fact that if you take the word by itself, v'aira, it should be v'aira. But that's not how it's supposed to read. So now, if you're still not convinced, I will convince you now, for the simple reason that a lot of people were thinking that this is the Ashkenazi, and we like to use tunes that don't go in accord with grammar, but obviously the Sephardim, they get it right. They'll get it right. Let me play you how the Sephardim read this, and you will see they all read it the way I just said, for the simple reason that this is how you're supposed to read it. So all those Chachamim telling you the tune is wrong, the tune is right. And how do I know this? Well, let me play you just a couple. I could do more. I found online what you can find today is amazing. Here is, this comes from Central Asia, the Caucasus. Just read how I'm not going to be able to read them all for all of you, but listen to all these different Sephardim, how they read it. And listen, let me make it loud so you can hear. Okay. Okay, so here you have in the middle of Asia, they read it properly. And this isn't because of some tune that some Ashkenazi invented in Germany. How about the end? Let me get it to the closer to the end here. The Sephardim have extra verses in it. So there you see it. Here do we have, here is North Africans. Look at how the North Africans recite it. Okay, there you go. Again. Let me show you another one. Here we... Oh, actually, let me show you... I think I have one more I want to show. Here, oh, here's sets of Tunis. I want to show you at the end here. 232, I made a mark here. Listen how the last lines are. Actually, sorry, that was the wrong one. We're a different one now. I'll do okay, whatever. Well, I have here, I'll play you from the beginning. This is Tunis. And if I can find it quickly here, these are preserving the traditional tunes. And finally, actually, one more thing I want to show you, and then we'll be done for today. But I think you'll find those interesting because those are traditional tunes. There's a Yemenite one also. I don't know why. Hold on a second. I thought I had the Yemenite one here. Do I have the Yemenite one here? I thought I had a Yemenite one, I see. But the Yemenite one was the, let me quickly just look here and see if it pulls up the Yemenite one. Because you have all the different, here it is, okay.
¶¶ تیری نمیره دنیا عالم عشر ملخی بتره میکنه یه تیری نمیره به عید نزه به عید تا کن از ای ملخی شمانی گیرم.
And then just to play you at the end. Aira, not Aira. And the last thing I want to show you in this is I found on that very site they have a sitter from 1616 in Germany. And look how they mark it at the end here, at the bottom here. Look how they divide it. V'yom Ekra, V'ayira, they divide all the endings there. Beit Sara, so that you know that they're separated. So that's that. It says at the top here, it says, Shir Miyateidu Shtei Tenuot, Miyateidu Shtei Tenuot. That's, it's not exact, it's, it doesn't always have that. But what this means is that the Ateid is, for example, the Shva or the Chatach Patach. That's the first Ya'adon, that's the first thing. And then Shtei Tenuot, Olam. You see the how the follows the motto, Asher. The Ateid is the first, the Shva, followed by the next syllable, and then the two Tenuot. Malach, Bete, then you go Remkol, Yetzir, Nivra. That's, not every verse does that, but most of the verses do that. So I rest my case that the way it should be pronounced is Melech, even though that's not grammatical, but that's how the poet intended it. He intended it to be Aira, Achbira, because he wrote it and he intended us to recite it that way. And if you look, Jews all over the world recite it this way. This isn't some Ashkenazic sort of thing. I see what you're saying. I'll get back to you then, Mel, about that. So that's my point. Very good. Let us move on now. But I think I made my case there that this isn't we have plenty of examples of pronunciation mistakes that where tunes go against the grammatical rules because we just invented the tune. But here's an example where the author of the poem wanted you to say it a certain way. And as I showed you, the first two lines, it has to be melech because it goes unaccented, accented, unaccented, accented, etc. Okay, my friends, we now turn to the sefer. We went longer than I ever went, but I thought this was, as you know, those who've been with me for many years, we just keep going. Like, what is it, Rabbi Tarfon? You know, we says in Pirkei Avos that we're not going to be able to finish everything. And hafochba, hafochba also, you can say, because I put on the YouTube, I give a little description of what we talk about, but someone emailed me the other day that all I mentioned was the actual things in the book we speak about, and I don't even speak about all the other things, but okay. We return to the Sefer. I'm in the middle of the letter. This is page 237 in the letter to Rabbi Mazuz, Simon Kuf Yud Dalet. And as I mentioned that I would write him, I would save up a lot of questions or comments and then send them. So this has maybe 10 different things. The next thing is as follows. He said he comes out, you know, with this weekly Torah sheet. So in one of them, he said as follows. He quoted the Rambam, first of all. We all know, or we should know, that if someone says, eat this non-kosher food or I'll kill you, you're not supposed to be killed. You're supposed to eat it. The only exception would be if the person was doing that in a way that's, say, to cause you to destroy, wasn't doing this for his own benefit, but to destroy Judaism, something like that. But leave that aside for now. We'll get back to that. But generally, we all know that, except for the three big things, Avodah Zarah, Shvichus Damim, killing someone, someone says, kill this person or I'll kill you, or certain sexual immoralities, martyrdom is required. And Rabbi Mazuz said, quotes the that the Rambam's position that there's no the Rambam doesn't just say you don't give up your life. Let's say if someone says eat non-kosher, the Rambam says you have the status of a suicide. If someone comes up to you with puts a gun to your head and says eat on Yom Kippur or I'll kill you, and you say, well, I'm going to be pious, I'd rather be killed. The Rambam's lashon is harezim ischayev benafsha. It's like you're a suicide, because after all, the Torah tells us when to give up our life and when not to. And it's not your life. It's not your life to decide what you're going to do with it. Just like we all know it's not our bodies. We can't just do what we want. We can't decide that I want to give up life now. I'm going to just commit suicide or something. Well, you can't say I'm just going to, you know, I can't eat non-kosher. I can't eat on Yom Kippur and therefore kill me. The Rambam is very harsh about it. However, the Shulchan Aruch, Beis Yosef, this troubled him. He didn't agree with this. And he said, Shleimim v'chem rabim, he says, many great people disagree with the Rambam that if you choose, you it's like supererogatory. Lifnim Mashir Asadim. If someone says, I'll kill you unless you eat or something, then you and you decide to be martyred, you're considered pious and holy. And so we're going to get back to this in a second. So we have a dispute here. The Rambam says you can't. The Shulchan Aruch quotes people who say you can. Rabbi Mazuz explained, what does it mean? What does the Shulchan Aruch mean? The Beis Yosef, I should say, mean when he says that if you are killed and didn't violate it, it's considered a great action. Rabbi Mazuz says he did a mitzvah gedola, the kiddush es Hashem. And he... And Rabbi Mazuz writes, he sanctified, and how does he say Hashem? He says, hey, with a dash. So I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz, is this a typo? Hey, with a dash? Because the word, it should be Hashem. Hey, shin mem. The sanctified God's name. Where does this come from, this whole idea? It comes from this pasuk right here. Let's see, do we got the pasuk here? Vayikra. No, it's not that Vayikra. Here, Vayikra, Perek 22, verse 32. What does it say? It says, you shall not profane my holy name. V'lotchalu es shem kodshi. V'niskadshi, v'nitashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael. You should not profane my holy name, and you should sanctify me. But the word here is shame. You see, that's where you get the idea of chilul Hashem. Because... It's not Hashem as in God. That's my point. So if you say Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem, it should be you shouldn't just use hey, because when we use hey with a dash, that refers to God. I also have another pet peeve that here you see here. People write as follows: Chilul Hashem. That's the word Hashem. That's how we write God. Hashem, God. That's not the name. If when you say Hashem, it's, and look here, look at the in the article. Why is Kiddush is and Chilul, they're lowercase, and Hashem, as in God, God. But it's not God. It's not Kiddush of God. And the author here knows it's not Kiddush of God, but he still writes Hashem, capital H. If anything, it should be small h, a dash, capital S, if you want, H-E-M, but not Hashem. So I asked Rav Mazuz, though, he knows everything. He writes, hey, Kiddush, hey. And so he replies to me, it really it's the same thing, because he doesn't really answer the question. He says, look in the pasuk here. Vindashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael, I will be sanctified. So he says that when you are sanctified God's name, you sanctify God. So therefore, it's okay to write hey with the dash. Okay, leave it there. I still don't like it, because people, when they see Chilul Hashem, just the hey and the dash, they assume it means, you know, sanctification of God, when it's not. But the bigger question is as follows, and this is when I... This gets us into a very, very important issue here. As I said, the Rambam holds that if you martyr yourself when you're not supposed to be, you're a suicide. However, the problem is that this is the position of the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah. But the Rambam has another work. It's called Igeres HaShemad. The Igeres HaShemad was written, the Rambam, you had this, the rise of this radical Islamic group called the Almohads. Yes, they were the Hamas, or the Islamic Jihad of medieval times. Now, the typical Muslim approach is, as it says in the Quran, is there is no compulsion in religion. But there's all sorts of interpretations over what that meant. The mainstream interpretation was that for people of the book, that is Jews and Christians, you couldn't force them to convert. All you could do is keep them in like in a second class status, the dhimmi. But pagans, of course, were given a choice, conversion or death. But there were the others who interpreted that verse in a different way. And the Almohads, they had a notion of conversion or death. They came into Spain. And they gave people this choice, conversion or death. The Rambam and his family fled to North Africa. They would then make their way to Eretz Yisrael and then Egypt. Now, the Rambam was asked the question because the people in Spain and in Morocco, what most of them did, not all of them, the Dayan of Fez, for instance, was burnt at the stake, we're told, because he refused to convert. But what most of them did was convert to Islam outwardly. What does it mean to convert to Islam? It's not so complicated like in Judaism. There's no milah or anything that's required. What's required is you say the Shahada. If you say it once with meaning, there is no God but God. Not there's no God but Allah. There's no because Allah is God. There's no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. If you say it one time with meaning, you're a Muslim. All you have to do is say that, and most of the Jews, but the overwhelming majority of Jews, that's what they did. And they lived as secret Jews, but outwardly as Muslims. In fact, the Rambam tells us that the Muslims knew that the Jews were not living privately as Muslims. I guess they figured over time they would become Muslim. The question, did the Rambam live as a Muslim? It's an interesting historical question because he says that all of us have to live like a Muslim. So was he speaking the royal we, or was he referring to himself? And he says that we all have to do this. So it's not a problem, quote, religious problem, because the Rambam's going to tell you that's what you should do. But this is a big historical issue that the Rambam himself has to live as a Muslim. Okay, so the Rambam, the problem was these Jews were challenged by this scholar. We don't know who this scholar was. The Rambam treats him as if he's some nobody, but he couldn't have been a nobody because when he issued his ruling that all these Jews are basically have the status of idolaters because they're living as a Muslim, the Jewish community was thrown into a quandary. If he was some nobody, they wouldn't have cared. So when this unknown scholar issues this ruling, they write to the Rambam, and the Rambam issues this marvelous work, the Igeres HaShemad, which is a defense of the Jewish community under siege, explaining that what you're doing is absolutely correct. There's no obligation to martyr yourself because Islam is not idolatry. There's a big difference between the response in the Christian lands when you were obligated to martyr yourself. That doesn't mean that the people who are not strong enough to allow themselves to be killed, as many Jews in France and Germany did, but in Spain, for instance, in Portugal, well, Spain, let's stick to Spain now, most of them did not, it seems, the majority. Converted from 1391 to 1492. And many of them later then fled to North Africa or the land of Israel. The difference is that they, although they were not treated as evil, but it was understood it was a sin and they were given various penances, tshuva, to do. But in what the Rambam was saying is that what you're doing is absolutely correct. There's nothing wrong with, because it's not idolatry, Islam. And therefore, all they want us to do is make a statement that, you know, God is God and Muhammad is his prophet. To save our lives, we make a statement. According to the Rambam, there's no ma'aseh, no action of idolatry. Incidentally, this position of the Rambam, which seems to make a lot of sense, was subject to dispute. The Ritva, the Radbaz, because you get into a big lamdashah discussion here. Chazal say that for if given a choice between avodah zarah or death, you have to choose death. What's the real issue here? The Rambam holds that the issue is you can't do an action of Avodah Zarah. That action of Avodah Zarah is so terrible that you have to, Yahar Vel Yavar, you have to accept martyrdom. So with Islam, there's no action of Avodah Zarah. It's a monotheistic religion. So of course, you don't martyr yourself. However, the Ritva criticizes the Rambam and then the Radbaz and others. And the Ritva says, thinks the Rambam's wrong. He says the real problem is not the action of idolatry, bowing down to the cross or whatever, to the idol of Zeus. The issue is rejection of the Torah. That's the capital offense, denial of the Torah. When Chazal were looking for an example of denial of the Torah, the example was obviously bowing down to an idol. Chazal, in the days of Chazal, there wasn't a conception of a religion that's monotheistic. Every religion was idolatrous. So when Chazal speak about an action of idolatry, that's showing rejection of the Torah. But now with Islam, the Ritva, for instance, says we have to get the essence. The essence is denial of the Torah. And when you accept Islam, by definition, you're rejecting the Torah. Because Islam teaches that the Torah has been fraudulently written. We've altered it. The real authentic text is preserved in the Quran, the authentic teaching. And therefore, by accepting Islam, you reject the Torah. The Ritva says, and this is the Peshat, he says in the Gemara, that is the actually not just the Ritva, others, they hold, that is the capital offense, denying the Torah. So if it's denying the Torah, if that's the capital offense, well, then if you're given the choice, convert to Islam or death, you have to accept Yehar Vayavar. So that's a big machokas among the Rishonim. Is it the action of Avodah Zarah, the Masa Avodah Zarah, which like the Rambam holds, or the rejection of the Torah? Let's leave this aside for now, because in the Igeres Hashmad, although the Rambam strongly defends this position of his, that it's only if there's no action of Avodah Zarah, you don't need to martyr yourself, the Rambam also says, but if you want to be pious, and you want to be holy, and you allow yourself to be martyred, you're kadosh, you're holy. You've reached a great height. So he leaves it as an option, which he does not leave in the Mishnah Torah, where he says that if you're not obligated to and you allow yourself to be killed, it's as if you're a suicide. So Rabbi Kafech, the great Rabbi Kafech, who we've spoken about already, he already deals with this in his note on his edition of the Rambam's letters. And he says the Rambam changed his mind. That when the Rambam wrote the Igeret HaShemad, he was young. Later on, he changed his mind and he didn't accept this idea that you can be pious, voluntary martyrdom, I guess you can call it. He rejects it. Rabbi Sheilat, in this work, his important edition of the letters, he has a different approach to explain this contradiction. He says that, first of all, he points out that we're dealing with an unusual case anyway, because in a time of shmad, in a time of persecution, you're supposed to give up your life for anything. And yet the Rambam says you don't have to. So Rav Sheilat wants to argue that this is maybe not a real shmad, because the Muslims themselves knew that the Jews, it was just for show on the outside, and that privately they were still being Jewish. He has a whole different approach. He doesn't accept Rabbi Kafich's idea. He says that in the case of where it's a shmad, a shas hashmad, then the Rambam would allow you to be a public martyr, a voluntary martyr, but not in other cases. So he tries to make that argument. It's not clear if there's a contradiction how to explain it. Rabbi Mazuz says, he thinks the simplest answer is as follows. He says the Rambam's position is, and always is, that it's forbidden to be a martyr, a voluntary martyr. However, if you go ahead and do it anyway, but if you go ahead and do it anyway and you have good intentions, we're not going to treat you like a suicide. You're regarded ex post facto. This is like someone, had you asked the question, we would have said not to, but if you went ahead and did it, we regard you as holy. Interestingly, this is the exact position of Chaim Soloveitchik. I saw his new volume, third volume, I have to get, of essays, came out from my favorite press, Littman Library. But that's how Chaim Soloveitchik understands what was going on, because you have a strange phenomenon. You have people in Ashkenaz, medieval Ashkenaz, not just committing suicide, killing their children. How can you kill your children? There's no source. So what, are we going to call them all heretics? Are we going to call them evil murderers? Not bury them in Jewish cemetery? He said that was impossible. Even the rabbis who assumed what they did was absolutely wrong understood they did it because they thought it was the proper thing. And therefore, although we will never tell anyone to do that, ex post facto, we have to regard them as kadoshim. And that's how Chaim Soloveitchik reads all the discussions as like ex post facto. And that's what Rabbi Mazuz says the Rambam's position is. That when the Rambam says you're holy, it means that if you a simple person decides to, like, just think we're back in Germany or in Spain or something like that, then a non-Jew comes and says, eat this non-kosher. And someone says, no, I will never do that. I would rather die than eat that. Are we going to assume that? And he's martyred. Are we going to regard him as a suicide ex post facto? Yes, the Rambam gives the halacha. But in the real world, if the person intended proper tshuva or whatever, if he intended to do this to serve God, we're not going to regard him as a suicide. Although then what's the Rambam talking about then in the Mishnah Torah when he says you are a suicide? It's a problem. That's why Rekafach says he changed his mind. But Rabbi Mazuz thinks no. Rabbi Mazuz thinks that's the halacha in the Mishnah Torah is like a theoretical halacha. That this is the halacha, and you tell anyone you understand as a suicide. But ex post facto will regard the person as a kadosh. I'm not sure if this is the best answer either, but this is, so we have three approaches to how to deal with this very unusual, apparently, change in the Rambam's position. Is there such a notion of voluntary martyrdom? In medieval Ashkenaz, voluntary martyrdom is taken for granted. And there's all sorts of Haggadic sources you can cite about people like the young people jumped off the boat to martyr themselves so they wouldn't be taken back to Rome and all sorts of other examples. But the Rambam is opposed to voluntary martyrdom, and it makes perfect sense. It's not our bodies. We can't decide on our own what to do. The next part of the letter is also, I think, of interest. Rabbi Mazuz, in his weekly Torah newsletter, said as follows, that if you send a letter, there's a city in Israel called Beit El. I was there last summer. No, not last summer, last January, a year ago almost. I was in Beit El. First time I ever was in Beit El. I went to Shechem. That was interesting. First time I went to see the Samaritans. They have a museum there. It's really very interesting. If you can get over the fact that we were stopped in a traffic jam right in the middle of an Arab village, and my wife is thinking we're all going to be killed and everything, but the driver showed us his gun. But still, if you've never been to Beit El, it's worth seeing. And I went to where is Eliezer Melamed, Har Bracha, all those places. Oh, okay, Beit El is a big city. I mean, it has lots of people there. That's where Avinir lives. They have a winery as well. We'll see if the wine from Beit El, beginning in January, if it can still be labeled from Israel or has to go back to territories. What is this Beit El? Is this a holy name? Can you say the name Beit El? Can you write? Can you send a letter to Beit El? In Hebrew, you send letters. Whenever I send letters to Israel, I use the Hebrew and then I just write in English Israel. It'll get there. Rabbi Mazuz says that if you send a letter to Beit El, you should write it as one word, Beit El, or make a line between the Aleph and the Lamed. So Beit El. Because you're not, El is one of the names of God. You're not supposed to write it. We're going to get to the names. I just said the name. We'll get to about next week about using the name of God other than the Tetragrammaton in Torah study. I thank Moshe for sending me stuff, and I found some good stuff. What I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz as follows. I didn't understand that. And that's not the minhag. No one does that. But I said to him, first of all, the Birkei Yosef. The Birkei Yosef is the Chidah. Chaim Yosef David Azoloi. It's his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. He brings different opinions. The question is that the word Beit El appears in Torah. First appears in Bereishis. Let me show you. This isn't a new city. Let's see. Hold on a second. It's here. If you look in it's here somewhere, I believe. Yes, here. So look in Pasuk 8. This is at the way beginning, where it says that Avraham moved to the east of Beit El. So apparently already you see that there's a Beit El in the days of Avraham. Well, if there's a Beit El in the days of Avraham, then the word, it's obviously not a God's name. It's just the name of the city beforehand. The problem is we have later in Bereishis where Yaakov names the places Beit El. And some people even say, some commentaries, that the Beit El we just saw with Avraham is named in anticipation of what Yaakov's going to do. So what's the other issue is it when we say Beit El, do we mean house of God, or is this just name of a city? If it's just name of the city, it doesn't matter what originally it was. And I pointed out in my letter that the after mentioning the Chida quotes opinions in both ways, the Chasam Sofer says that this word Beit El that we see in Torah is not holy. You have all these names. If they're holy names, the Sofer has to have special kavana. I think he even recites it. I was just thinking, he recites it. It's a holy name. Sometimes they will go to mikvah before, maybe even today before writing it. And then there's letters that aren't holy, even though named Elohim, Elohim Acherim. So in yeshiva, we'd always say Elohim Acherim, and the Rebbe would have to tell us, no, no, there it's Elohim Acherim, because it's foreign gods. That's not a holy name. The Chasam Sofer says it's not holy, and therefore the Sofrim are not Makadesh that name. And what's the Chasam Sofer's proof? Take a look at Unkelus. Unkelus does not translate Beit El, Beit Eloha. What does he write? He doesn't translate it as house of God, the word he would use if it's holy. He just writes Beit El. So it's just a city name, that's all. So I said to Rabbi Mazuz, I don't know why it's so simple to you, that with the Chasam Sofer and the positions of the Broad Nechida, that it's not a holy name. Why do you feel that when you write it, you should have the line? I said, do you really think that the meaning of Beit El was Beit Eloha, house of God? And then I said, Derech Agav, there are many synagogues in America that are called Beth El. And I said, but with regarding these synagogues, there's no question that when they say El, they refer to God. Every synagogue, and Orthodox synagogues too, are called Beth El. And yet when they use the word, and they're not naming it after a city, they intend to mean house of God. Well, if that's the case, I said, I don't know why the rabbis never rebuked the Balabatim that you shouldn't call a synagogue Bethel. Because when you write the name Bethel, then you are really writing God's name, because they intend it to mean house of God. So these are the two questions I have for Rav Mazuz. One, I guess, Lakula, that we should be able to say Beit El. We're send a letter to Beit El because the Chasam Sofer and others. And others, that what about all these shuls, including Orthodox shuls, I think in Newton, isn't it? Where? You can type it in. Where are the Orthodox shuls are at Bethel? They're definitely in Brooklyn, I think you even have a Bethel. People can write it in where they know of Bethel Orthodox synagogues. And I said, that's a problem. How do we allow synagogues that have the name Bethel if it's God's name? So I see we're already at the end, so we'll get the answers next week. And we'll also, actually, it's a good time to then speak about this whole issue of saying God's name. We're going to see a dispute between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Sephardim don't even believe in saying things like Kael, etc. Ah, there you go, Broker. That's right, Young Israel Bethel. That's where I spoke it. I spoke last year. Baruch was there, was with us. In fact, Baruch, who's with us, he will testify next week when we speak about Satmar, where he brought me. So you see my Satmar connections. But I guess Bethel and Young Israel are different synagogues, and they merged. So how did the rabbis allow us to call synagogues Bethel? So we will get to the questions. We'll get to Rabbi Mazuz's answer next week. A couple other interesting things we'll see from Rabbi Mazuz. Trup. How to understand the meaning of psukim based on the trup, and are we bound to the trup? We'll see that next week. And Rabbi Doctors, wait till you hear the Kanai, the extremist Mark Shapiro, what he says about Rabbi Doctors, and how Rabbi Mazuz, speaking as one myself, but how Rabbi Mazuz defends the Rabbi Doctors, because after all, the Rishonim, we'll get to that. And then we'll move into Satmar. What is Mark Shapiro doing with one of the greatest Satmar Talmidei Chachamim, and my relationship to Satmar, and why Satmar, we're going to criticize them, no question, but they really get a bad rap. There is so much good in Satmar, which people don't usually see. And we will get to that next class. Time flies. Oh, and let me remind you all, or we'll hear that I will be here next week before I get to the questions, but double next week, because Nittel, Christmas Eve, I will be giving a special talk, special class on should we be studying Torah on that night? And we'll get to that. Yes, okay, Rabbi Matanki, that was the name of the rabbi. So anyone who's interested, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, really a great Talmud Chacham, based in not just in Chicago, but at the RCA. You can read what he wrote in Lehrer House. And Daniel Chill says Rabbi Schwartz's first job was as a rabbi in Providence. In fact, in the Sefer. The Sefer is written when, I believe, when he's a, let me pull it up for you to show you, when he was a rabbi. Then he was in Englishtown. He has a Haskama there from Rav Aaron Cutler in the Sefer. Rav Aaron Cutler was, the Sefer is called, I'm looking at it now, Divrei Regesh. No, this is 59. This is after he was in Providence. This is when he was in Englishtown, New Jersey. He was also in Providence. He was not a student of the Rav, by the way, Rabbi Daniel Dov Schwartz. Of course, anyone who was at Yeshiva College, he was Yerzeit Chanan, had relationships with the Rav, Yerzeit Sharon. But he was not, he was this, Rav Poleyev, I think also Rav Moshe Shatskis, and in other words, and Rav David Lifshitz. But the Rav was not, like you think of people who are, went through YU or Smicha with the Rav, that was not his main Rebbe. I don't even know if he was ever even in a Shir. Larry says, I wonder if this has to do with what they were using for light. When I used to use candles, I used the shamash both for the lighting and afterwards to be the youthful light. But now that I use oil, I have one oil light used to serve as a youthful light, but I light the other lights with a flame starter. I wonder, okay, what they use, nair, we use as candle. They don't mean candle. They mean, and when the Gemara speaks about nair, it means a what's the word I'm looking for? Not a jug, but a lamp. There you go. Thank you, Evan. And that's the shot of when you're learning on Friday night. You can't learn next to the nair because you'll tilt it. What do you mean you'll tilt it? If it's a candle, you don't. But because the oil starts going out, so you move it so that the oil then continues and you can, so I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it has to do with that, what you suggest. And you wonder why you light the useful light last. It seems that you should light it first. There's no time you'll be making use of the sacred lights. You have to look in the Torah. The Torah is asked this question. You make the bracha, then you light everything. And then afterwards, then you light the other light. If you light it, I guess you could light it. Let me read you what the Torah says. You could light it, I guess, beforehand, but that wasn't the practice because probably the reason is because the first thing you're supposed to do is the mitzvah. The mitzvah is the first thing you do. Then you do the other thing. If you do that, that's what I'm thinking just off the top of my head. It's not the mitzvah. So you wouldn't do that. And Mel says they're poetic forms of words. This is Kuma Bezras Yisrael, which is a poetic form of Kum. Yes. Well, that we have all the time. That's called the cohortative. That's the technical term in biblical Hebrew. Cohortative, and there's another type like Eshmara. Why not Eshmor Shabbat? Eshmara, I shall indeed. That's not the cohortative. I forgot what that's called in English. The cohortative is like, let us, Nishmara Shabbat. Let us observe Shabbat versus Eshmara, or I will indeed observe Shabbat. I don't know really. If you look in the grammars, they always say the hey at the ending when it's not the cohortative, when it's the other term, which I can't remember these fancy terms, that it's emphatic. But I don't think so. I think Mel's correct that it's more poetic. David says another rhyme in this week's parshas, when Yehuda promises his father, Bet Nun Vav at the end of both of them, which interestingly is a brilliant rhetorical tool to win over the argument with Yaakov for using to bring down Binyam by Yehuda, using Yaakov's own words he had already used. Chatena mida tivakshena, chatena tivakshena, if I'm pronouncing it right. Very nice. Okay. The difference is, though, that what I showed you, Osacha, is that that's not a normal form. That's not even a regular form. That's just like a form used just to rhyme with the Kacha, Osacha. And that was pointed out by Grossman in his book. I had never known that or thought of that. So it's you can see it on HebrewBooks.org. It's a nice, if you're interested in these sort of things, it's a nice book. Half of it's in English. Ellen says that the Central Asian singing, the accents weren't as you said. I'll have to listen to it again. I said, certainly the Melech was, I thought. Someone privately says that if you listen to Benno Weiss' rendition of Adon Olam, which is said out loud in those shoes will keep Minig Ashkenaz, all are Milra. Everything is include also Melech and also Ayira. You may also find it on Machon Marishas Ashkenaz site. I tried to get the renditions of Benno Weiss. They're in Dartmouth, but so far they haven't yet given me permission. And then you say the fact that it's not said out loud at the beginning of davening for all to hear the tradition and for all to hear the tradition pronunciation is lost. That's right. We don't say it anymore. Incidentally, the it seems that it was originally supposed to be said at night, Adon Olam, or if not at night, first thing in the morning. Because remember, the Ishan Va'ayira. So I shouldn't say at night, in the morning. That's the original place to say it, right when you get up. Because you said, I gave my soul to God, and now that I get up, he has it.
I had the privilege of learning Adon Olam word for word with Rav Breuer. Yeah. And I asked the question, why do many shuls not say it? And he said, it's Chabal, because it's all Kabbalos Amach Hushumayim. And everyone should be starting davening with Adon Olam.
Okay, thank you for that, Howard. I don't know why we don't say it. Susanna says the usual tune for the piyut, Achol Katana, is like that, also accents in the wrong place. Yeah, and I think my point basically, that to sum up, is that we have plenty of examples in the davening that the accents are in the wrong. They really are in the wrong, but it's not such a big deal because it's a song. So songs we can, it doesn't really change the meaning unless it's of perfect and it's above. But my point with Adon Olam is it's not even wrong because the Paitan himself wanted you to sing it that way. That's how he wrote it. Yes, Barry says Rabbi Gershon Siegel Shul. That's Bethel. Yes, that's what I was thinking of. What about G-D rather than G-O-D? That's a dispute. You can look at Rabbi Blech's book. There are some who say there's no reason to do that, and others say no, that God's name, even in non-Hebrew languages, also has to have, shouldn't be written. It shouldn't be erased, I should say. Or also shouldn't be written, some would say. So then I didn't really, I forgot this, I read this. Yeah, Baruch says that Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz was the young rabbi of the Young Israel Borough Park years ago, the one we've been speaking about. He took over the Daf Yomi in Borough Park, I believe, after Rabbi Shmuel Kalman Mirsky, who took it over. And then I think that was the big Daf Yomi. Someone asked, can I make my article on Nittel available to participants? The talk is going to have new stuff, lots of good new stuff. But if I make it available beforehand, no one's going to want to come and hear me. So I will. And we do have, there's an earlier version that we put online, but this is before YouTube and it was 9 years ago. So Rabbi Kelman thinks putting on one more time so everyone can hear it and it can go on YouTube. And who remembers it? Unlike you, who listens to it every year, most people don't remember it. And finally, Rav Mel says, my rabbi quoted Rav Rimon's new sefer in a shiur earlier tonight. Rav Rimon says one can light the shemash either before or after the other candles. Normally we think of the shamash as the one you use to light the candles. The problem is if you have one of these oil lamps, you have a shamash, but you can't really use it to light it. So you use another candle and you light the shamash. You don't need the shamash. The shamash is not, it's not halacha moshe Sinai or in the Gemara. But if you do have it, you can't have it on the same line, things like that. Daniel says the etymology of doctor is from the Latin meaning teacher. Rabbi means teacher. Rabbi doctor is redundant. No, I would disagree. Because doctor is telling you you've been awarded based on non-Torah knowledge. That's why you're given doctor. The rabbi, although the whole idea of smicha, as it began in the Ashkenazic world, might be based on what they were doing at the universities. At least that's what the critics said. But doctor is not for Torah knowledge. It's doctor is for either quasi-Torah knowledge or secular, but doctor's important, and I believe Jill Biden should be given her title. She worked for it, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google Dr. Jill Biden, the blogosphere, and the news is going wild about someone who dissed Dr. Jill Biden. And that is it towards the end. Thank you all very much tonight. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Yes, hi. I just want to announce and encourage, you know, as we come to the year end and on Hanukkah, we're asking people who contribute and donate to Torah in Motion. I'm putting the link to the donation page right here. Since the pandemic started back in March, this is our 285th class. If we include the seven classes that Dr. Mark gave on Adobe Acrobat before we switched to Zoom, it's actually our 292nd class of the year. Over 25,000 people attended. If you add up all the classes, the attendance, all the classes, our downloads are up by 500%. We've had 70 teachers, and all this imein kemachin tour, all this costs money, and we make all our classes are free, but we'd like to ask everybody to consider either sponsoring a class, a sponsor a day of learning, sponsor a Dvar Torah, give whatever you can. We're trying to raise $50,000 for the OP between now and the end of the year, so we'll be able to continue and expand the program. So please, I do encourage it. People, you can't get this value. If you had to pay for it in a university, you'd be paying literally thousands of dollars. So, you know, we encourage you to do what you can. And the link is on the bottom of the page. And thank you very much. Like I said, we're going to be announcing it, you know, over the week. And we hope you'll participate. Thank you.